Hi, and welcome back to part two of the Network 5 Emergency Medicine Journal Club podcast on LGBTQIA+ identity and culture. Next, we have Caroline presenting a qualitative study, Navigating Medical Culture and LGBTQ Identity, published in the Clinical Teacher.
So the study I've looked at this month is titled Navigating Medical Culture and LGBTQ Identity, written by Lindsay Toman, published in a journal called The Clinical Teacher in 2019. This is a qualitative study which focused on the experience of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and queer medical students as trainees within the medical profession. The purpose of this study was to investigate how LGBTQIA+ medical students navigate medical school as minorities and how sociocultural behaviours within medical culture contribute to their overall well-being and mental health. In order to explore this, 12 LGBTQ medical students from four different medical schools in Michigan were placed into focus groups in 2018. These students were recruited initially using flyers posted in healthcare facilities, college campuses and businesses, with subsequent use of snowball sampling to recruit further students. The first focus group comprised of five participants, two of which were medical students. The second group comprised of four participants who were all medical students recruited by the initial two students. And the final focus group comprised of six medical students who were contacted via LGBTQ medical student groups. The responses of the initial two medical students helped to guide further questioning and discussion for the subsequent focus groups, and measures were taken to protect participant confidentiality. Data analysis was based in grounded theory perspective, which allowed for patterns to emerge within the data collected. The prominent themes which emerged from this study were fears of repercussion of identifying as part of the LGBTQIA+ community, a lack of mentorship for these students, and the added burden of being a non-white person as well. So just to expand on that a little bit, within the theme of fears of repercussion, some students cited the fear of jeopardizing their future professional career opportunities due to concerns of negative reactions from their future employees. And this was exacerbated when they witnessed discriminatory remarks about LGBTQI+ patients from their colleagues. In terms of lack of mentorship, this study suggested that the fear of discrimination prevented LGBTQIA+ students from forging close relationships with their teachers and mentors. Some students reported that they didn't trust anyone, and others commented on the heightened sense of isolation that this created while navigating an already stressful university degree. For students from non-white backgrounds, the fear of discrimination for their sexuality was viewed as an additional burden and one which, unlike their race, they felt they could and therefore should keep concealed. The conclusion of this study highlighted the importance of implementing programs to support diversity and welcome differences amongst employees and students alike. It raised the need for deliberate support of the LGBTQIA+ students through advocacy and conditions that encourage affirmation and positive mental health outcomes. So, although this study is extremely small and set in the United States, I think it raises some incredibly important considerations for students and trainees that are part of the LGBTQIA+ community, not just our patients. Looking through the ASEM website and some of the available links that are available for trainee well-being and the promotion of diversity, I actually found there was little to no mention of the LGBTQIA+ community, other than a post acknowledging marriage equality in 2017 after the referendum was passed. And I don't know if I'm not looking in the right place, but if it is there, it's really not that easy to find. It would seem that we are sorely lacking representation of our LGBTQIA+ colleagues within the training program and the emergency profession as a whole at the moment, and this might be some space that we can really work to improve. Reflecting on the findings of this paper and the importance of mentorship on student wellbeing and development, there are clearly several avenues that could be explored to improve the experience of our LGBTQIA+ colleagues. And I think further research on a larger scale and obviously set within Australia and perhaps even within the ASIM training program itself would help to further explore these issues. And it might even highlight some potential opportunities for positive change. So although it was a very small paper and I guess just probably a pilot, I think it does raise some really important issues and maybe hopefully gives us the opportunity to talk not just about our patients who are obviously very important to us, but also to talk about our colleagues and how we can promote their well-being. And I think that would feed back into patient care as well. So I just wanted to focus on a slightly different area.
Thanks, Caroline. And again, I completely agree. I mean, I think we often think about these things in a patient bent, but rarely about our colleague. The thing that strikes me about this is that, you know, these were people that responded to flyers, right? This is a select proportion of the LGBTQIA plus population within medicine. And I would hazard a guess that there are plenty of people that may not pick up flyers, that may feel more restricted by their sexuality or gender in their clinical practice. I know that my experience of this as a gay man has been interesting best, and I've had very different responses from practitioners, and there are many instances where I have chosen to keep my sexuality. As someone that's quite, I think, outspoken generally, it's something that I don't tend to advertise in clinical settings, and that probably is for a fear of discrimination or judgment.
Personally, when I was reading through this paper, although it wasn't necessarily specified, at least reading the comments that were made that they chose to highlight in the paper, it really felt like as much as they were just talking about the LGBTQIA plus community, it really felt like it was just the LGB bit that was being represented. There was no discussion at all of gender diversity. And I think where that comes in is because that's something that you can't hide as easily in certain situations. Personally, I was working at the Children's Hospital at Westmead for almost 5 years before I had the need to come out as transgender. And with that came a new name and new pronouns. And if I want people to use them, I have to tell people that. So I can't hide that part of my identity. And that created a lot of internal conflict because of something that was mentioned in that paper, the fear of repercussions. I had senior clinicians that I'd worked with who had made comments in passing or had made joking references that were transphobic or homophobic or racist. Some of these were people that, if I was wanting to pursue a career along a pathway that I was going for, were going to be people that made decisions around whether or not I'd be able to pursue those opportunities. And so I had to make a really difficult decision about, do I continue pretending to be someone else at work until I end up in a position where I'm in this particular training program or I have this job or whatever? Or do I tell people and take that risk that that might negatively impact on my career opportunities? That's something that I think wasn't necessarily covered in this particular paper, but is something that's very much important, as you mentioned, for looking at future discussions and future research. It's a bit different now where I'm in a position where I've been out for a very, very long time and I could apply for a new job. And now the decision I have to make is, do I tell them I'm a trans woman or not? Because they know I'm a woman. They can see that. They know my name, everything else. And so I can kind of hide that if I want to, but it's a bit different when, you know, early days, or if you're not going to be medically transitioning, or if you're in a job where you transition in the workplace, like I have to do and like some of my colleagues have done. And so that's something that I thought was an important point to look into further, because thankfully it didn't cause any negative impacts for me, but it was certainly something that I was very much afraid of. And not really having anyone else in the healthcare system at the time that I was aware of that had gone through a similar experience that I could turn to ask for advice or these sorts of things. I now have met other transgender health professionals, which has been a really wonderful source of support, both professionally and personally. But at that time, I was flying by the seat of my pants. It was very, very stressful, which when you're, you know, trying to work as a registrar in a pediatric intensive care unit and you're doing 5 12-hour night shifts in a row, and it grinds you down a little bit.
Thank you. That's a really, really good point, that actually gender identity is harder to hide than sexual identity. I just want to touch on a point which I think might overarch this whole topic, is heteronormative culture. So this is a term which basically describes the assumption is that everybody is cisgender and that everybody is heterosexual. And it's very pervasive because most of the population, you know, probably 80 or 90% of the population identifies as cisgender and identifies as heterosexual. And it's really challenging when you are a person is young and they don't fit any of those categories. Just bring it into the cultural context. I know for one, I was born into an Indian culture. And so I knew I was different. I've always known I was gay or, you know, attracted to men and being a man myself, a cisgendered male. So I kind of always knew that, but I didn't know that. And I had a lot of self-shame, a lot of doubt. I found medicine difficult, believe it or not. I'm very outspoken at the moment, but in the UK, the culture is very much more hierarchical than Australia. In the United Kingdom, I did my med school and I found it very challenging to come out, believe it or not. And I also found it very challenging to come out with my work colleagues. What changed was I really had to almost bite the bullet. I think Australia made it slightly easier that I arrived in central Sydney. Certainly, it seemed to be more accepted. I quickly identified with nurses and doctors and other colleagues, you know, who had piercings in their ears and, you know, different colored hair. And but in the UK, that would just never happen, really. And I was privileged because I'd been part of a group in the UK called GLAAD and I'd marched with them. And that's where I kissed my first boy, who was also a doctor and he was gorgeous. And I was in the middle of London on top of a bus in scrubs. And so what this paper kind of says is that for me, it was easier for me to be gay and a medic than be gay and Indian. It's intersectionality. It's like, which one is the least worst that I can kind of hide behind? And in the medical field, it was easier just to say, I'm a professional and not talk about my sexuality at all because of fear of repercussions of job or career or anything else. You know, it's this self notion of how much you allow yourself to be yourself without it hindering your future prospects and things. So it can be really, really, really challenging. And I think this paper kind of just highlights that. And then I came to Australia and I still hadn't really made peace with being an Indian person. But I, at that point in time, because I'd been part of GLAAD UK and I got a bit of confidence, when I started my new life, I was in a different country, miles and miles and miles away from home. From the first day I arrived in Australia, that was what really changed. I didn't hide my sexuality. And I think that first 6 months to a year was interesting. To be honest, I really had to face my own demons and I knew it would may or may not affect my career. You know, it's plastered all over my CV now because I run a queer doctors association. I mean, it's very hard to hide behind. And now it's very much like the bell curve I described earlier is, well, I'm so much on the other side that it doesn't affect me. But when I was in the beginning, you know, feeling quite vulnerable and my first job in Australia was at Bankstown, you know, with a population which is very culturally diverse, but not necessarily sexually and gender diverse. And to speak up there, where I had colleagues who were also Indian, nursing and medical colleagues, and tell them what homosexual is, it was an interesting couple of years. I think most people would say, oh, you know, it's been easy for you, but that's the kind of description of where I was at that time. And so there's no real answer or solution, but I think I agree with the paper that if we can offer some support within our profession to this vulnerable population, medical students or doctors or people, you know, by being role models ourselves or by showing up. I think showing up is a really, really important term. Showing up will help others. And the strength I gather now is, you know, I run an organization now where I just see the glee and the smiles, back to Dervla smiles on these, you know, 80 health professionals who march down Mardi Gras every year and the pride and joy and what they're going to take back and how their lives have changed. You know, this is why I have endeavored to do a Mardi Gras float every year for the past 11 years. It changes people's hearts and minds. And the public, when they see that there are health professionals walking down that road, that's been something so close to my heart. And it has stemmed from me enduring that pain, me enduring that self-identity struggle. And I think this paper really highlights it. As a medical student, I can relate so much to what this paper says. As a person of color, I can relate so much to what this paper says. And even now, I'm doing a job up here in the Northern Territory and I've been offered a mentor. You know, I don't have aspirations of having a mentor who is also queer, but it'd be nice to have one. And I think that stems from, well, it's only 10% of the population are queer and so it's hard to find and things. And so in myself, I really have gone by the slogans of be the changer you want to see, because as a queer person, I realize I may not get that mentor that I seek. So I have to be that mentor that I seek. And to do that, I know that I'm paving the way for other people. And that's what I go to bed with and think that it's all worth it for a reason. It's for me, but it's for others. And that's the spreading of the love or spreading of the pride. Why do people have pride and why do the straight people not have pride? Interesting question. We don't need a personal celebration, but why not have one? And why not have something that you can build your own resources? Why not have an area or space where you can be proud? Much like Ashley touched on in the previous paper, where if people want to be themselves and want to affirm in a certain way, why don't you just let them? It's kind of cool. And why don't you come along and see how happy they are? That's kind of cool too. And if you can share their happiness, oh my God, that's amazing. And just watch how happy they are. Isn't that cool? Isn't that fun? And I think that's what I say to Muslim nurse, like, you know, why should I wear the pride badge? Well, do you believe that everyone should be happy? Yes. Do you believe that, you know, we can all work together? Yes. Do you believe that we should all deserve equal healthcare and that we should all be the best versions of ourselves? Yeah. Well, the rainbow doesn't actually mean gender or sexuality. It just means you and me. It just means us. And we both had a little tear and it was really cool. And that was incredibly moving, that the faith, it's not the faith, it's what's in your heart. And that's the conversations I have these days. That's what's really important, that you can shape and move somebody who is so ingrained in something else. But let's all become who we are, because there's room for all of us. And that's what I say to people who march on the Mardi Gras float that I run. You know, that's the whole point of something like this, of this podcast. I want you as a listener to be so proud of who you are. It doesn't matter who, what anybody says, you walk down that road, be who you are, because then nothing can stop you. Nothing. Even if you're straight and even if you like to wear a tutu on Saturdays, just do it, man. Woman, non-binary pals, just do it. Just do it.
Wow, Bhushan, thank you so much. I think you're going to have a massive list of people I want to go on the float for next please. Mardi Gras. Can I book a ticket, please?
Yes, please. Come. You know, people don't realize what it is. People think it's party, drugs, alcohol. You don't know there's a whole world out there. And you don't need to say every day that you're gay, queer, lesbian, transgender, any of those things. But when you do, do it with purpose. And do it so you can transform someone else and do it so you can transform yourself. When you do, heaven and earth will move for you. And it'll move the people that you educate and the people that you talk to. That's why I sit on this side of the bell curve now. This is exactly why. And that Islamic nurse who cried with me, it was a sharing of hearts in that moment. I know for one that that person will never judge in that same way again. It's transformative. This is our role as role models, whether you are queer or not. That is our role. Isn't that why we went to med school? You know, and if we can help these medical students who describe these experiences, we're looking at a completely different profession.
Bhushan, that's really powerful stuff. And I think, you know, as a community, as emergency doctors, as medical professionals, we owe you one for bringing this to Australia and bringing the advocacy to Australia. Caroline very astutely alluded to the fact that we still have a lot of work to do. I think we shouldn't be in a position at this point where finding LGBTIQA representation on our college website is a difficult thing. I know that you're part of the College Inclusion Committee. I'm just interested in what your experiences of inclusion have been within the college in Australia, and also where you think we need to go.
The college website, as we all know, is very hard to navigate, and it's very difficult to find resources. And so I can tell you, as far as I know, I sit on the inclusion committee, I have done for the past 2 years. As far as I know, there are resources, but they're not in the best place we need to. And the college acknowledges that. The college also acknowledges that we have a lot of work to do. I am only allowed to speak of what I'm allowed to speak because I'm also part of the committee, but we have done behind the scenes and we are still doing a lot of work. The diversity survey was the first of its kind in Australasia. In the UK, I know that GLAAD UK run diversity surveys all the time. And so they work out demographics of which staff are identified as queer and et cetera, et cetera. A year and a half or a year ago, college ran its first diversity survey. And so the results of that survey will be disseminated very soon. The college is one of the first colleges in Australasia, our college, ASIM, to actually have a diversity committee. And the committee speaks to the board directly. And it also speaks to who we partner with and what we do, and also the Council of Education. So little measures we've been implementing are to have representation in college staff who we actually employ. So they have to be, you know, from a diverse range of areas. People who are elected into new committees, particularly the Council of Education and the advocacy side and the board, are also now selected based on diversity. So we used to have a board of examiners, which were mainly white middle-class men. That is very rapidly changing to reflect gender, sexuality, as well as color, culture, and religious differences. And the college takes this stuff very, very, very seriously. Some of the stuff that is cooking in the background is the college is actively thinking of starting a network called Queer EM. I wanted to call it Queen, but it doesn't quite match up. Quem kind of comes out. So Queer EM is probably in the pipeworks, and at every single conference, probably from now on, we are probably going to be having a queer event. The college last year supported GLAAD directly. They were a big source of funding, and they hosted a event for World Pride, or co-hosted. So the college were very helpful in that. And so we had our first college and GLAAD event together. So the college is very interested. They're very interested in putting up educational talks and topics as well, and relevant resources onto the college website, because the college sees that there's a need. I have to apologize if it's not there yet. I also acknowledge that the college is a medical institution. Also, there's meetings and there's papers and bureaucracy just by the nature of the system. So things take some time. I also know that in the pipeline, the college is in the process of making a position statement, or would like to make a position statement, about transgender and gender diverse care. And that will be part of its new progression plan for the next 2 to 3 years. This has all occurred in the last, say, 2-3 years. The college kind of set up an inclusion committee in response to complaints it had received regarding OSCE candidates and cultural implications. And I think the college has really, really taken that with its stride and is moving forward with that. So I can only tell you what I know and what I'm allowed to tell you as a member of the inclusion committee. I can really say, watch this space. The inclusion committee, I can vouch for, is incredibly diverse. There's gender diversity, sexual diversity, cultural diversity. And we are very much wanting to implement that and educate our college with that, and our fellows and trainees, and actually implement it as part of curricula, although it's very, very hard to assess, as well as part of a wider culture. So I can only allude to all of that, but there's a lot of work that is happening in the background, not to necessarily defend the college, but I can very much attest to doing that. I was very apprehensive, I must say, when I joined the inclusion committee as to whether the voice would be heard, but it very much is inclusive of all aspects of diversity.
Thanks, Bishan, for clarifying that. I definitely didn't mean to kind of criticize the college specifically, but I think it is really reassuring to hear that there are things like that going on in the background that hopefully will come to fruition, and to hear that you felt that your voice has been heard within that diversity committee as well. That's really great news to hear. So thank you for clearing
that
up.
But it's a really important point. You know, I mean, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
You know, the intention is there, but we're not there yet. And I think that, yes, agreed, like you said earlier, there's work to do. And it's right to point out what we don't have, because we can only make change when we point out what we don't have. So it's not a criticism at all. I think it's actually very positive feedback, because already it's saying there's a need. Let's crack on. And so this is much, so for the college, certainly if there are members listening and things, this is much more of incentive of like, this is needed. Let's crack on.
Obviously, as a pediatric trainee, the college I'm involved with is the RACP. I'm not involved in any processes. I don't know currently where things are at with the RACP. What I do know is that 18 months to 2 years ago, when I was looking for some of these resources for personal use, I found it to be quite lacking. I'm hopeful that if nothing is being worked on there at the moment, the work that is being done by people like Bishan and with ASAM will hopefully spur some of the other colleges to make similar statements and to move forward with developing these sorts of things as well, because it's all well and good having it for emergency medicine, but there's a lot more to healthcare than emergency medicine. I have had the privilege in the past few months of working with the University of New South Wales, who have a queer medical society for their medical students, and have been provided some education sessions for some of their students. I've also done some education sessions for the New South Wales Medical Student Society, who have been doing a lot of topics covering various queer and other diverse groups and then talking about the importance of being respectful and acknowledging the unique difficulties that may come with people from these populations. There is a lot of work being done in this space at the moment, definitely in New South Wales, and I'd hope in a lot of the other medical schools across the country, hopefully a lot more than there was when I was at medical school, which was only a decade or so ago. I don't recall ever getting any discussion really about gender diversity or anything like that. Things are improving across that space.
I was just going to quickly mention a point that a team or group of people that are really, really high-flying and making changes with stride are Queer AMSA. So the Australian Medical Students Association and the Queer Division, and they are superstars. I learn from them every day. They have been champions in producing, you know, documents for gender-neutral language. They have already started making OSCEs about transgender care, asexuality, gender-neutral language. So they are already making big strides in this area, and they're a great group to collaborate with and grab resources from. And that's where the need is, but they're making their own changes. And I think a lot of the colleges certainly have a lot to learn from that group, and certainly a lot of the medical schools have a lot to learn from that group. I am very hopeful that, you know, people like them and even us educating ourselves will enact a domino effect, which will then follow through into medical school as well as college curricula and education. It's very much required.
Totally agree with what everyone's saying. I think the earlier, the better. And thanks, Caroline, for presenting the paper, even though it wasn't a particularly robust sort of study. It really made me reflect on how things are changing compared to my experience. I think what you forget is I went to uni in the UK like Bhushan, and it is super hierarchical. I think what we forget is for the first time in a young person's life, they enter into a new phase of actually discovering who they are and their identity. For a long time, you're with your family, you attend school, you fit yourself into some sort of box that is normative. For me, that was identifying as a girl, Irish, straight, Catholic. All of these things that I came out of my family with, I had to realize, well, which ones am I going to let go of? Which ones don't feel right? And that's really lonely. And it was quite a stressful experience. And so it's not surprising that our members of our communities will experience mental health problems. And this is the time it's actually most likely to happen. You've moved away from all the things that you've known, and suddenly it's up to you, right? And unless you have that confidence or the role model, you know, you have to go and seek that for yourself. So I think the more that we can identify allies when we're in med school and have these groups that we can join, the better. Yeah, I find it so lonely. Gosh, I hadn't thought about it in a long time. And I remember coming home after my first year and crying to my father in the car. And I said, I don't think I'm supposed to do medicine. And he said, why, you know? And I couldn't articulate to him, and I couldn't even articulate to myself, is that I didn't feel like I fit in with that group. You know, I didn't see anyone who was gay. I didn't speak to anyone about my struggles. I just tried to do what I normally did, which was fit in, and it wasn't being true to myself. And I think I've already alluded to the fact that I haven't been brave, and probably there's some shame around that as well. But I think that can only improve, and attitudes are improving. And I think we're so lucky to be born into this era, and it's our responsibility to add to the cause. You know, the reason I got to marry my wife was because other people were brave enough to stand up and advocate for me to have that right. And so as a gay clinician, it's my responsibility to sort of add something to our community's lives and really uplift people where they need uplifting, having been ashamed and scared for a long time. So yeah, and what I felt was great, I just become relatively a baby consultant. But one of my OSCE exams was I had a gentleman who was a gay man who was on PrEP. And I just thought, amazing, this is great. I know about PrEP, you know, and it was such a natural conversation between me and that actor. And I was actually very proud of the college for putting that in there, because we need to know about this. And again, the same with transgender care. And I think it's only going to get better. And I thank people like Bhushan who are part of these committees and working towards that.
To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, as you did your emergency medicine training, weren't in any formal advocacy role. As people who just engaged in training from an emergency medicine training perspective, how did you feel that you were looked after being from the LGBTIQ community. And what do you feel the role of the college should be?
Oh, looked after. That's an interesting term. And again, that plays back into how confident you feel identifying as LGBTQI plus and letting that be known in your workplace. I think for me, I can easily hide it, right? And that's one of these strange privileges, you know, I can pass as heteronormative and I don't have to disclose. So for me, I guess that was a conflict. And coming out again, I don't think we spoke of really coming out. Coming out is something that you don't do once and then it's done. It's like you got to come out every day. And although I don't complain about it now and I do it as much as I want, there's always that split second where in any given interaction, you have to decide, do I need to really tell this person and do I trust them enough? And how will that make them feel about me? And, you know, will I or will I not win in that interaction? So, you know, I'm a lot better at saying, no, my partner is female, you know, because partner is one of those words that is safe and doesn't, you know, can be played both ways. But emergency training, I just thought was grueling. I think we'll all agree. I don't think being gay sort of stigmatized me, but I understand how it might make others feel. I think what Bhushan is working towards will make a massive difference. We are acknowledged in the space and offered extra support. And I actually think offered mentors. I know it's difficult because we're 10% and we are a minority, but I think highlighting that need in that space might encourage people to be a part of a mentee mentor program where they feel that their identity that is different can be supported as they go through all the different steps of their training. And like Bhushan, moving from the UK to hospitals in New South Wales, mainly metropolitan, I was surrounded by gay consultants. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I was like, is this just emergency medicine? And I think if we get this right, I think we're going to recruit some really great doctors from medical school, you know, because we're going to be that inclusive and hopefully pediatrics too, Ashley. It just takes one college to take those big steps where then everyone realizes that it's something, it's their responsibility to address and to help clinicians along their journey. I think there's space for more improvement, but I'm very privileged to be a part of the college now and confident in who I am and hope that I can help others in that space too.
I'd echo those thoughts. I guess I come from a, you know, a little bit of a different background. I kind of grown to accept my sexuality when I was quite young and came out reasonably young age. And, you know, I came out in school and I kind of resigned myself to thinking that there were just no other gay people in the world. And I'd never been in a relationship. There was no one else like me. And so I actually found particularly university, particularly my undergrad, but even medical school, quite a liberating process in that it allowed me to find these like-minded people. You know, I grew up in the Bible Belt of Sydney and in the UK for some of my formative years, and where I lived was quite conservative. And so I think, you know, then moving to the city, going to a city university was kind of brilliant. The area in which I found work medicine most challenging from a sexuality perspective, I work in Western Sydney. It can be quite a conservative area. And I've had many patients, particularly around the time of the referendum, that have made kind of off the cuff comments about sexuality, presumably thinking, you know, because I'm quite mask presenting for whatever that means. I'm sure there are better phraseologies than that. I've had patients that have made quite homophobic comments, thinking presumably that I'm a generic straight white man that I've found difficult to reconcile. And that's where I continue to struggle. To be honest, if my colleagues don't like that I'm gay, well, no. If my patients don't like that I'm gay, then in a sense threatens a therapeutic relationship. And in a sense, that's then they're not going to know that. And that's not going to be something that I can then easily correct them on. And I still haven't worked out a way to negotiate that.
I find similar experiences. I feel very privileged to be part of this community. I think I haven't really received any direct discrimination from emergency medicine staff. We tend to be a very accepting work environment. There is a slight difference between acceptance and celebration of who you are. I'm quite content and satisfied that I'm just accepted. That's okay. Like, you know, I don't need to be like, wow, you know, but patients are challenging. And sometimes, and particularly in cultural areas like Western Sydney, I commonly get, oh, you look like my son, you know, and then, are you married? You know, kind of comments, particularly because I'm a person of color. And I just say no. Like Dervla was mentioning, there's different areas or places where you say, yes, no, actually, I fancy men, or versus you don't, because what's more important is that doctor-patient relationship. And you've got to remember, it's not about us. It's always about them, isn't it? I mean, that's why they're in our department. So I often just go, if they directly ask, I go, I don't know if that's really relevant, but I can tell you if you really want to know, but I'm more interested in you. And I'm here for you. And, you know, if they're really pushing sometimes, you know, then you say, well, you know, well, no, I'm not married. Oh, do you have a girlfriend or something? And I think I just kind of go, look, there are lots of diverse people in this world. I'm just here to serve you. That kind of keeps it really clean sometimes. It's difficult to do. It's taken me a long time to kind of spill out those phrases. But that's come from years of having that kind of rhetoric come to me. Again, is it really obvious that I'm gay? I don't think it really matters. You know, like much like you mentioned, Kit, that sometimes you can hide behind the veil of being quite masked or quite femme. I don't even know if that's even a thing because, you know, heterosexual men can be quite feminine too. So that's not a thing. But I agree that societal norms would then dictate that if you're more flamboyant, people will question more so your sexuality. We have to educate. That's where the societal norms are going to be changing through us, I guess.
I suppose in any other discipline in my life, I would stop people and I would pick them up on these things. I don't feel empowered to do that with patients because there is an authority role there. I think we have to be a bit careful with how we do that. I haven't worked out a strategy for that yet.
And I fully agree. They're still our patients. I agree with you entirely. I don't want them to feel tuck-tuck. We're having a go at them. I think there is a subtle way of educating, which I think I'm just learning as well.
There are those patients that just won't sort of get it. And when that happens, I think I was challenged by it around our other recent referendum and commentary that I heard from patients that I was treating. And we have to acknowledge that it's hurtful, like to the person that we are still humans. Yes, we're clinicians and we have this relationship that we have to take care of at work between patient and clinician. But it's okay to acknowledge that that hurts. And the way I try to manage it for myself, Kit, is to try to tap into compassion. I don't know about you guys. I seem it's a lot of older patients with very fixed ideas on the world and life and their experiences. And I actually then feel sorry for them because unlike me, they have not had the opportunity to be educated, to grow, be challenged by other people's opinions. And so when I feel myself getting hurt or angry, I will walk away from it and then I'll feel sorry for that person because they're missing out on what we get to enjoy every day. That's how I feel. I don't know if it would help.
Agreed. And sometimes walking away is a strategy. Sometimes, you know, being neutral like myself is a strategy. Another way, I mean, just because you mentioned it, is to say that comment's very hurtful. That's kind of interesting because humans don't innately want to just hurt people. So it's just nice to point out without making them feel the blame, but just, do you realize like that comment's a little bit hurtful, just so you know.
With no stakes in this particular game, as my caveat, I do think that labeling is sometimes useful. Certainly it's in other spheres. It's something that I use if I find a patient being uncomfortable. And it doesn't need to be personal. It can just be about what is being said rather than about who the person is. And that's, I think, sometimes something that gets lost in the very binary debates that we tend to have nowadays.
And I think for me, I don't want to come in and say something that isn't correct because I'm someone that doesn't identify as being part of the LGBTQIA+ community. But as a person that works in the emergency department and with many colleagues that do identify and wanting everyone to feel safe, I think I don't know whether being able to have these conversations more openly allows us to maybe deal with the things we can't control at work. So dealing with patients can be stressful on many accounts. And I find that when I have a really negative interaction with a patient, being able to talk to my colleagues about that is really helpful and really important. And so I would hope that my colleagues, if they were experiencing things like this, would be able to come and talk to me about that, even if I haven't necessarily had the exact same experience myself. But I just think, you know, maybe going back to what Bashan was saying and remembering that we're all human and we need to have compassion for everyone in order to be effective clinicians and do our job. We need to really be there for each other, regardless of our backgrounds, and remember the difficult job we have at times.
And I think there's a lot to be said for looking out for your colleagues. So, Caroline, I don't think maybe someone might come to you directly, but if you witness that interaction, because we're all over the place and sometimes we can overhear things, we should never allow ourselves or our colleagues to be abused. And if you ever feel like you're being abused, well, then you are, and you don't have to put up with that. And that's why we have that zero tolerance to violence and abuse. So allowing yourself to feel that you can walk away at any stage, we should. If you see a colleague equally suffering some form of abuse or discrimination that's not okay, then yes, be an ally and come in.
I think communicating that you're willing to do that to your colleagues is also really, really helpful. I think back to my own experience of when I essentially had an email that went out to the entire hospital to come out to everyone at once because I didn't want to have the conversation with thousands of people. When I arrived at work a few days later with a new name and looking a bit different and all the rest of it, I had multiple colleagues who were not part of the queer community come up to me and first of all, congratulate me on coming out and bravery and all the rest of it, which always feels a bit weird because it's like, it's not so much brave. I kind of just have to do it by my own personal reasons. But to then say, if anyone ever says or does anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, that makes you feel unsafe, whether that a patient, whether that a family member, whether that a staff member, whoever, come to me, let me know. I'll be there. I'll back you up 100% of the way. And thankfully, I've been really, really lucky in that I haven't experienced anything like that, you know, short of like the occasional 4, 5, or 6-year-old being like, you sound like a boy, but I don't blame them. But it's really helpful to know that you've got people in your court. You can assume that people are going to back you up, but to have someone actually come up and say, look, I'm supporting you is huge. And that makes things so much easier.
Thank you, Caroline, for presenting that paper and getting another amazing discussion. Could you give us a couple of take-home points from your paper?
The real take-home point from this paper for me is just to remember that not only are our LGBTQIA plus patients important, but our colleagues are also incredibly important too. And they may face slightly different challenges. And it's something that we as a medical community need to work together towards making much better so that we can all function well. But I just really want to drive home that point, if nothing else. I think it's something we all need to take responsibility about being aware of. And regardless of where you sit, something I would like to think we can all take an active part in trying to make better.